Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. We're so glad that you took the time to download us and you're listening. As we do every week, we have another interesting person from the world of sports medicine and human performance for you this week as an interview. I'm really excited to welcome Mr. Dave Weir to the podcast today.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to the podcast, Dave.
Appreciate it.
I'm going to tell everybody a little bit about you, and then we're just going to jump into the conversation.
Okay.
We have Dave here today. He is the head football athletic trainer for the Texas A&M football team. He has been athletic trainer for Texas A&M football for 25 seasons, 13 of which as the head trainer. He is currently the chair of the advisory board for athletic trainers for the state of Texas, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And a lot of experiences in a lot of different sports as well. And with football season upon us, we're here to talk about athletic training and football and a variety of other things.
Great.
So again, welcome to the podcast. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what made you decide to be an athletic trainer?
Well, it was a decision I made early on. I guess coming out of junior high, I decided that I love sports and love being involved in sports, but didn't see myself as the gifted athlete, and but wanted to be involved. And a high school coach recommended athletic training to me and said that that there were some camps in the summertime that were offered by various people that I could kind of go get my feet wet and see if this was something that I like to do. And so the summer between my junior high and years a freshman in high school, I attended one of those summer camps and kind of fell in love with the profession. And then into high school, kind of became a student athletic trainer at Brenham High School, did that through 4 years of that, and worked football, men's and women's basketball, the freshman year, and then I moved into women's basketball and then worked baseball. So it was, kind of a love that I found early on, and just have stuck with it.
Now, we've all seen changes in athletic training besides the professionalism side of things, certainly from injury and rehab side. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Give the folks a little bit of an idea about what you have nowadays, what you have to do to become an athletic trainer. It's not as easy going to a camp in middle school and then you wind up being the head football athletic trainer.
The pathway is a little bit more defined and paved now. Certainly the profession is better known. It's still a little bit unknown to many people out in the world of who are these people that go out on the field and see an injured athlete that may be laying there that's having difficulty.
You get to run 40-yard sprints all the time, don't
exactly,
you?
And make sure and try to hope that you don't fall down on the way out yourself. So get grabbed by one of those what we call turf snakes or something like that and trip over a line.
Yeah.
But it's the education side of it now, it is pretty well paved through either an established internship programs through colleges or through what we call Acadia accredited programs, and those there are undergraduate programs and graduate programs, which Texas A&M has one of those graduate athletic training programs. And so, but students in any case, at the time that they kind of decide that want to go through this, then typically we in the collegiate level are approached about what do they need to do that. And so whereas at Texas A&M we have an undergrad internship program that puts those people eligible upon graduation to sit for the state license exam and become a licensed athletic trainer in the state of Texas. And then if they seek national accreditation or national certification, then they could go on through the master's program. At other college universities, there are undergrad curriculum programs that are in place that some students may choose to go into. So the pathway there is a little bit better established. But, one of the things that I think is the value of athletic training is becoming better and better known. When I first came out of Texas A&M in 1990, it was, you know, athletic trainers were certainly found at the professional collegiate levels and your larger high schools. But now we're seeing the smaller high schools beginning to employ athletic trainers. And athletic training has moved out of what we call the traditional setting and dealing with, you know, amateur or professional sports teams into the clinical and industrial settings. I mean, they're athletic trainers that are working with our military, working with NASA, working with General Motors, and working for fire departments, because people have realized the roles that we have and the functions that we have doesn't necessarily stop at the athletic field. Right. That injury that might occur in the workplace in many cases could be treated and rehabbed by an athletic trainer, and the person could return to function or return to work maybe faster than just dealing with it themselves.
It's about human performance in all of its different forms.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's not just on a field of play.
Right. I mean, we were talking to somebody at one point, and they said, like, Disney, at Disney World or Disneyland, they have, I think, 6 full-time athletic trainers that are there for the performers
in
the parks.
Yes, sir.
So there's a large job and career opportunity there for that.
Exactly. And they're, you know, because those large organizations, I mean, they may have company teams that to promote health and wellness, that they have leagues and things like that, but many on the job injuries can be dealt with. And you know, I was talking to one of the NASA athletic trainers, and I said, you know, what is your, you know, what are some of the things that we're doing? She said, well, you know, I have to deal with astronauts that come back with shoulder difficulties because the normal spacesuits that were made for the older spacecraft don't allow for a lot of shoulder movements. But now the astronauts are asked to perform a lot of movements to work on spacecraft, and so they get tied down within the suits and have limited range of motions and things like that to deal with. And so she said, I see overuse injuries in our astronauts as they're training to do, you know, flights and things like that and do spacewalks.
I'm glad you brought that up. That actually closes the loop. We interviewed an astronaut one time, and that's what he said. He said, I had shoulder problems. He did several EVAs up in space, and it's like that was the biggest problem we had was shoulder issues because of the suits.
Exactly.
So really cool. So there's been, I know, a little bit of a discussion in the field about changing the name, because people get athletic training confused with strength and conditioning. Often they think as an athletic trainer that you're down there helping people push weights and things like that. What's your take on that?
Well, the name that has been a debated topic, and it's about what best describes our profession. And I think probably many athletic trainers would say, had we had to do it all over again, you know, 30, 40, and 50 years ago, would we have called ourselves a different name? And probably most of us would say we probably should have.
Yeah.
But, you know, at some point in time, you get so far down the road as far as making a change, you know, it's very costly, not just financially,
right.
But also name recognition, regulatory authority. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, as chair of the athletic training board, you know, I spoke to NATA and we talked about the logistics of changing a name. And when you are referenced in your laws and things like that, you know, those things, it doesn't just take a memorandum from Dallas that says, now you need to start calling yourself this to start changing your practice laws and those types of things. So it's very far reaching. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I guess now I'm kind of on the side as, you know, I'm an athletic trainer and I'm not looking to really change my name. So I'm not a proponent of a name change.
Right.
You know, I'd say if we had probably do it all over again, we might have should have had 30 years ago.
So everyone listening, athletic trainers do?
We're providers of sports medicine to athletes and to people in the workplaces that have sports-related type of athletic injuries.
There you go. And so everybody will just have to learn that, right?
That's right.
That's what we're in the business for, education.
Exactly.
So certainly most people, when we talk about sports medicine nowadays, and especially in the context of football, there's a lot of discussion about concussions. Can you give us a little bit from your context, because you've been in the business a long time, is the extra attention good, bad? Have there been more concussions now because of the attention, or I guess more recognition of concussions? What's your kind of take on this whole thing?
Certainly, I think there have been more diagnosed concussions. Mm. I don't think that there's probably more concussions. You know, that we have known that this has been an injury, but the recognition now, the importance of athletes to recognize and also to report is far greater. And we have to, as athletic trainers, we are a part of that education process too, in which when our football team reports in August, and you know, we go over, and concussion is one of the things I go over with them, and we cover the 22 different symptoms of a concussion, and we tell them it's not your job to try to diagnose yourself. It's just, if you're having these symptoms or any one of these symptoms, come to us.
Just recognize and
come to us. Allow us to evaluate you and refer you as needed, and things like that. Because as we tell our athletes, is that, you know, we all know, you know, it's a physical game, and sometimes you might play with a sore ankle or a sore knee, but you can't play with a concussion. You have to be 100% fully returned, fully recovered to safely go back to without risking a more long-term injury. And that's what we try to say. You know, hey, you need to report that so that we can limit or minimize the downtime that you're going to have. Mm-hmm. Because we all know, if you return with an unresolved concussion, that next one could be really serious. It could take you months to get over. Mm-hmm. And so while they may miss 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 days initially, you know, we'll trade that. So, you know, but, you know, obviously, it is a hot, hot topic. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, when you go through and you do, you know, literature searches, and you go through and you do media searches, the amount of concussion, information that's out there is really big. You know, there's been concussion laws almost now in every state that defines how concussions could be dealt with, particularly at the high school level, and trying to identify who are those team of people. Mm-hmm. To be in the decision-making processes, right, and making sure that the, you know, the appropriate people are and the inappropriate people are not, and it's a tough decision. It's a tough thing, and we understand most every athlete wants to play, but sometimes you just have to make that tough decision. This is not in your best interest or our best interest for you to go back out there and play until you're fully resolved.
Have you seen over the last, especially 5 or 6 years, that the underlying, philosophy of the sport has changed, that players are more willing to come forward and say, hey, I've got this symptom, as opposed to in the past, at least when I played, you know, the deal was just strap it up and go. If you can walk, you're fine to play.
It has gotten better, but I don't say it still. It still happens. You know, that an athlete doesn't want to admit to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope I don't have one of these. I hope I don't have one. Mm-hmm. And then the symptoms kind of keep lingering. And in many cases, they'll say, well, you know, it happened early in practice, and I just hoped it would go away. But by the end of practice, man, I tell you what, you know, my headache got worse, and I was having a difficulty. I don't remember half of the practice, and you're thinking, okay, how many hits did they take in that intermediary time that's going to make things longer? And so, you know, it still does happen, unfortunately. I don't want to tell you that it doesn't, but I think athletes, they understand what those symptoms are. It's not a situation, well, I didn't know that was a symptom. I don't get that anymore.
Right.
They understand what they are, but their desire to play is still so great that they are a little bit more hesitant to report.
Yeah.
But I will say it's a team approach. It's not uncommon for a coach to come over and grab me and say, hey, check so-and-so. He doesn't seem right. Okay. Mm-hmm. He took a hard hit earlier, and, you know, he is just not right. Or even a fellow player. And because we put some of the onus on the players as well. It's your obligation to report for your teammates as well. Look out for your teammate. Be a good teammate.
Yeah.
And if you feel like something is abnormal, all you have to do is just reach out and tell one of the athletic trainers, and they'll evaluate and see what, you know, if they do, if they suspect that they do. If we suspect that they do, we've got to err on the side of caution and pull that day and evaluate. And then we have lots of tools at our disposal now to better evaluate, and more things that we hope to come. You know, we're in a partnership with some research right now with you guys and this institute, and looking at things. We have baseline studies that are established to look at individuals to help us know when is it safe to return an athlete. So no longer do we just have to rely on, do you feel like you're back to normal? And
do you know your name?
Yes. Do you know your name? And right. Because that's so stuck in long-term memory, almost everyone gets that right. you know, now we're looking at balance testing, and we're looking at short-term and long-term memory recall and processing and reaction times, and we have definitive baseline data to be able to look at it and utilize in that return to play.
And I guess that was one of the things – I'm sorry to cut you off there. That was one of the things that I guess I wanted to bring up. It's difficult to diagnose concussion. And sometimes difficult to make that decision on return to play, isn't it? I mean, that's something that certainly has been developing.
It is. I mean, of course, some of them are pretty black and white that you can, you know, they come in and their symptom scores and things like that are way up there, and they cross over, and you can tell that there's multiple parts of the brain that are involved in the particular injury, and so some of them are a little bit more black and white than others, and then there's some of those that we'll say, hey, you know what, you may have just kind of got dinged today and a little bit stunned, and you know what, we'll see where you are tomorrow, we'll test you, we'll put you on through our baseline, through our post-concussive testing programs, neurocognitive testing, balance testing, and all of those things. And hey, if you're good to go tomorrow, you know, we'll look at that data and we'll put you back. It's not our goal to have to hold you out any longer than we need to.
Right.
But in almost all those cases, you know, those things will define and show themselves, you know, pretty soon.
Yeah.
And you'll know the next day is this guy fully recovered and fine, or is this a guy that's going to need a few days? And we tell them, you know, everyone's a little bit different, and you know, we can't tell you it's going to be an X amount of days or X amount of time to be out.
Yeah.
You know, we know the typical average concussion in many cases will be fully resolved in about 5 to 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
but that's an average,
mm-hmm.
and some go longer, some go shorter. And certainly those of athletes that try to stay through and take subsequent hits, those start going past those 7 and 8 days. And it also depends on that history. And that's one of the things that we start looking at, because, you know, I always get the question, is what's the magic number when you should stop playing? I said, no one knows that magic number. It's not been defined. One of the things that we look at and our doctors look at is what are those recovery times looking like?
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
how long did it take you to get over that first concussion versus the second versus the third, sometime maybe the fourth? And we start looking at those windows.
Mm-hmm.
And when those windows start getting larger, then you start knowing, hey, we're having some residual carryover with history of concussions here, and now we have to start making some difficult decisions on what's in best interest of this particular player.
I mean, some of our colleagues right down the road in Austin are having to make that decision right now with their
yes,
quarterback.
Sir. And it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough anytime as a medical professional we have to start talking about, you know, a player's career and things, you know, but every one you have to say, hey, you know, football and sports is really a small snapshot of your life. We've got to do what's best for you. We want you to be a productive person, productive citizen, be a good parent one day, be able to carry on and have a relationship, you know, with a significant other. And so, you know, all of these things are so very, very important. And we know, obviously, there's a lot of court cases out there of individuals that have tried to play through concussions and early onsets of dementia and major personality disorders and early instances of Alzheimer's and various other brain conditions that are being triggered. And right now, you know, we feel like some of that may have been sped up and driven by the repetitive concussion or playing with a concussion that's not completely resolved. So, you know, we have to always take that, you know, into first and foremost account of what we're decisions and recommendations that we're making.
Do you get much pushback from coaches about your medical decisions?
No, sir, I don't. And I really say I have been very fortunate to work with coaches that are very understanding and trust us as a medical staff, and understand that we're truly all are on the same team. You know, but it's tough. You know, I'm a person that has to go in and deliver, you know, bad news to the head coach.
Mm.
You know, and in many cases, the people that are around those coaches
stand at the door, right?
Yeah, many of those people around coaches. You know, the coaches every day out, they don't have to give a lot of bad information, negative information. You know, and so that's sometimes the challenging of the job. But you know, our coaches that we have, they understand. They see the media side. They see the media reports as well,
mm-hmm.
and they
mm-hmm.
see those situations. And you know, they're very supportive and understanding. understand that's it is, you know, injury is a part of the game.
Right.
And
it's a pretty violent game.
It is. It is a very violent game. And when you look at my athletic training room on Sundays after games, you know, you can tell sometimes, you know what, we're pretty beat up.
Yeah.
And we've got a short window. You know, the next one's coming. Mm-hmm. No one's going to delay the next one on Saturday.
It doesn't stop
until you get to the end, and then that's when you're hoping you're playing for something really, really important.
So you were telling me a few minutes ago, we were talking about a conversation you had with a young man today about playing, and you asked him about, he said he felt well, and he said, do you feel well enough to go through, a car wreck or something?
Well, and that's one of the things as an athletic trainer. It's, you know, we have to know a little bit about football as well, mm-hmm. and the sport that we work up.
Mm-hmm.
And in different positions have different responsibilities and certainly different requirements. And those go into play into knowing if an athlete can go back and do his particular role and the things that he has to do. And if you're a middle linebacker, you've got a lot of things going on around your feet and around your legs on every play. And there's a lot of things happening. And you know, if you are a step slow and not completely, you know, ready to take on and do something because of an injury that you have, you certainly risk re-injury or injuring something else or not being able to make your assignment,
mm-hmm.
and putting somebody else that's around you at risk. So, you know, those decisions all have to come in, and I'm fortunate to have a great team of athletic trainers and a physical therapist to help me, mm-hmm. and do the jobs that we do. And so there's not just two eyes doing what we do out there, and it's very much of a team approach. I mean, we've got, I guess 118 guys right now on our roster, and so
it's a lot of people.
And, you know, there's always going to be guys on the injury report.
Yeah.
You know, there's always guys that, you know, some are there that are not going to play anymore that season because they've already had a season-ending injury and maybe has already required a surgery or in some cases a surgery that's been required, but they're going to be several weeks away because they're getting through rehabilitation and return to play activities and things like that. So we have athletes at all different stages, and some that are, you know, obviously that we're treating that may never miss a practice and that we're just seeing something that's a minor problem for them, and they're going through, and all the way down to those guys that are not going to return anymore that season.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, we talked a lot about concussion today. We're going to have you come back because we need to talk about some other things as well.
Sure.
But what's the second concussion gets all the, I will say, glory at this point, a lot of attention, right? What's the most common injury that you guys have to deal with?
Well, you
put your finger on one of them.
You know, in football, it's obviously the traumatic. I mean, it's a high speed, you know, basically injuries to the body, which they're, you know, the sprains and strains, mm-hmm. the contusions and those mm-hmm. types of things that we see. You know, obviously, the lower extremity injuries, you know, where there's knees and ankles and those types of things. But shoulders. Mm-hmm. Shoulders have crept into there, and some of that is a little bit more of the style of play mm-hmm. that we're working with now. You know, we're not dealing with no longer the forearm blocks that used to be was the form of blocking, and now, you know, that their hands come into play, and mm-hmm. we're doing a lot more with our shoulders, and I think the maturation processes and things as kids grow up, you know, kids are doing less of climbing trees and climbing on the old monkey bars that we used to climb on when we grew up on playgrounds, and so the dynamic strength of the shoulders are not necessarily being developed as good as they, I think, are as good as they once maybe were.
Across
their lifespan as they go through, you know, maturity and things like that. And so, therefore, we see in many cases athletes that come to us that have had shoulder injuries back in high school that may have not have been treated or taken care of well, and in many cases come in that are damaged that eventually we may have to fix, and that have some labral tears and things like that that are causing some shoulder instability and problems. And so we have to actually have to go in and address those things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's an injury that we're seeing a lot of, and, you know, wind up with, you know, sometimes three and four postseason shoulder surgeries. And some of those have come to us. Some of those have happened, you know, under our watch as well, and just the nature of the game.
Right.
So,
like I said, we're going to have you come back because we need to talk about these things. But before we sign off here, we were talking earlier, and you related a story, and it's not everybody that has somewhat celebrity call them to ask them to serve. And so we said earlier that you were on the state advisory board for athletic training. You're now the chair. So relate the story, repeat the story about how you got put on the board.
Well, it's a very prestigious board. It's you know, our licensure law is a little over 40 years old, and there's been you know relatively few chairs and few board members. When you look at, we regulate a little over 3,000 licenses within our state, and so my particular case was got a call from the governor one day and actually asked me to if I was willing to serve in that capacity, and I think I paused about 1 second and said, certainly, sir, I would be happy to.
It was the governor that called you.
And, yes, sir. And so, you know, and he said, well, I normally don't make these calls, but I needed to know how we looked this week and how healthy we were. So, but anyway, so that was that particular case. But it's a true blessing to be asked to serve in this capacity, and one of those things you would just not turn down, to know that you would never probably ever get have an opportunity or be asked again. So it's a lot of fun.
That's when certain people ask you to do certain things, you just can't turn them down sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dave, thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
More than welcome. We'll have you back.
Okay.
But before you leave, though, as always, we want to have you give the folks that are listening a take-home message. What's your take-home message? If they remember nothing else from today, what should they remember?
Well, we spent a lot of time on concussion, and I probably would not have, before our topic today or conversation today, I probably wouldn't have gone here. But, you know, if you feel like your son or your daughter or yourself, you know, have sustained a mild traumatic brain injury, don't continue to try to play through that. Mm-hmm. Seek medical attention. See if your family doctor is the best resource person for you, then see them or see your athletic trainer and report that injury, because trying to play through those things really risk a long-term problem for you, and it's just not worth that.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Big deal. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
And again, thank you all for taking the time to download and listen. For those of you that are regular listeners, you know that this is the time of the week when we have our podcast question of the week. And today with a question is our producer, Ayland.
How long does the average concussion symptoms last?
Great podcast question. Be the first one to send us the correct answer via email to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast t-shirts. And we've got the third edition of those shirts in, so answer away. So, again, thank you all for taking the time to be with us this week. We hope that you join us next week when we have another interesting person from the world of sports medicine and human performance. And until then, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Kelly Selman and Ayland Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.